strength I don't know how to play. And I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive's fucked. Zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my.
Hello and welcome to, let's call it the 15th episode of GamerCore. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and this is, we are returned from hiatus.
Yes, a glorious, glorious return. We didn't really have, there's just a lot to discuss, and I think we wanted to circle back to some of the stuff we've covered already. And so rather than
a single topic,
we figured we'd hit a couple different things and go that way. So I don't know what we're even going to call this title, but whatever, don't matter.
Yeah.
First off, how you been?
Can we call it Nigger Strikes Back?
I like that already. I like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. Yeah. So how you been?
Good. Whatever. I've been doing things that are not the podcast, right? You know.
Sure. Yeah. No, we both have, and which is good. It's good to do. You know.
Yeah.
IRL important stuff. People get, I think, too wrapped, myself included, very much, yeah. You know, wrapped up in like...
Started 3D printing again.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about that a little before the show. I didn't realize, so you...
It's a lot harder than you think.
I understand that it's finicky. I've never even tried, so yeah. I have no reference frame for...
I'm doing like the base level, like the PLA, not like resin or anything, high speed or glass filled PLA or glass filled, whatever, you know, nylon, or I'm just using regular.
I didn't realize there was glass in the filament. See, so I'm even that ignorant.
Oh, that's actually not always, but that's what like if you use like industrial plastics, like a Glock, mm-hmm. the bottom part of it, that's generally like not just plastic. It's glass gives it more rigidity.
So you mean it's not literally tactical Tupperware?
I guess it's not. I wonder if Tupperware has glass in it. Probably not. It's clear.
Question, right? Yeah.
But a lot more plastics do than you think.
Mm-hmm.
And this one doesn't, but that's not why it's hard. It's hard because it's like finicky and,
right.
I don't know. I would say I'm getting like probably 1 in 5 of my prints are good, which is okay. I'm almost done a Glock, single Glock magazine. I've also done some things that aren't, you know, weapons.
like 40K miniatures? Cuck!
Those are the hard things, right? Like miniatures are probably the most difficult thing to print because the, you know, level of detail, right? That is very difficult to match.
Yeah.
You know, I think the ideal use case is like small, replaceable, industrial, or mechanical, like small engine, or not engine, but like a small piece.
Yeah, things that don't. I think the ideal case are things that could be metal but don't need to be.
Yeah,
and so you just produce those at scale, right, or whatever. Not even scale necessarily, just like on your own without having to deal with aluminum machine tooling. Yeah.
I would compare it to. It's harder, but it's almost comparable to like. Reloading for a mm-hmm. rifle specifically, like you can tailor a load of a hand load to a specific rifle. I think you need to tailor your print and all your settings to your printer. I think they're so new and finicky that every printer likes a certain thing. I think I'm trying to dirt filaments as well. But I have had good ones. I'm not totally black pilled, but it's tough. And it is like, it's also The dream is, right, you just set it for a 3-hour print and you leave, but no, because you got to come back every hour to see if it's fucked up and you're not just like spitting filament into the ether, it's a skill to learn, right?
Yeah, well, like many things, it's yes, exactly, the practical knowledge for the future. So I guess, yeah, I mean, we sort of alluded to it maybe, or you know, since we're already kind of, you know, on a weapon adjacent military adjacent topic, maybe we could, well, there was some news I guess the other day about the British Royal Air Force. We talked about the recruitment crisis in the US. It seems they're having their own recruitment crisis in the UK.
Different though, it seems.
Well, worse in certain ways, right?
Yeah, like, no, I mean, like, devastating.
Yeah.
So that is, I think Sky News reported it. In Sky, they're not like, I wouldn't call them the Fox News of Britain, but they're like a
They are Murdoch properties, though, right?
They are, but they're not like...
No, they're not like explicitly...
conservative.
Yeah.
The thing is, they're more than the BBC. It's like to the right of the BBC.
that's not saying much, but yes.
Well, you know, to the right of Angela Merkel. I don't know what you want to call her. Yeah. I guess probably pretty in line with like German centrism.
I was going to say. Yeah, actually probably, in line. Probably more about where Angela Merkel would be. Yeah.
But the head of recruiting, general whatever British name.
Topwith Forblethwaite.
Yeah. Resigned in protest, which is generally like a thing officers don't do when they get to that level. Maybe he had enough retirement. He got sick of it. He punched out, resigned in protest, claiming that the targets he was given...
Recruitment targets.
Recruitment targets he was given for diversity, to like bring diversity in line with whatever level of diversity they want, were utterly unrealistic, and that he had been told, although there was no official directive, to stop offer. They call them offers in the UK. Mm-hmm. Like you offer somebody like almost like just a normal job. Like,
oh, okay.
They call them, you said, stop extending offers to white male recruits, which is the...
pretty much exclusive.
What is the RAF?
Yeah.
Like, what are we...
Yeah. Well, especially for, I mean, you could sort of squint and, you know... And
the RAF is tiny. They're not having a manpower crisis.
Right.
The British Army has occasionally had manpower issues.
Right, but flying a plane is not like carrying a rifle. Right, I mean, yeah. You know,
or also a million other air-related tasks.
Yeah, like, even maintenance, frankly. Yeah.
Maintenance is like aircraft maintenance is very difficult. What is it? I had a friend who worked in it, and he was telling me like they had tools that were measured in
for fractions of a millimeter or whatever. Yeah.
Well, instead of like you know a point you know 0.01 of a tolerance, it's like 0.00001, you know, it's like the tolerances are extreme and even more extreme. Military aircraft are an even higher grade of precision and things.
No, this is high IQ work, and this is, you know, in an industry that was pioneered, developed, et cetera, exclusively by white men over the past 100 years. So it's just, and of course, I mean, the glare, I mean, you know, maybe we're even giving it too much credit at a certain level. The UK is not the US, it never has been in terms of its racial composition. I mean,
yeah,
I guess
it's still like
it's like 70% white.
I have seen I think I've seen like it's like 85. There are there's like different ways of so they measure white in two ways. There's like white British,
which is
85 to 88, mm-hmm. and then like you get to when you include like Germans and Poles and Irishmen,
it's like 90%.
It's like you get to like 90 plus, 92, 94. It's hard to measure,
right?
But like so, there's no way you're getting, and you know they're putting in American style targets.
Oh, right.
Because
They're worse than the U.S.
There's enough, like, I mean, Indians and Asians that probably cover, like, 8% of the RAF some, like...
whatever it is, yeah.
But they want...
They probably want, like, a
20% black. Yeah. They probably want... you've seen things like, we want 30% women. Like, retarded shit. Like, shit that's, like, literally impossible.
Well, the thing that gets me about that, about the U.K. situation in particular, is how much worse it is in certain ways. Like, they're like the most extreme rabid ideological libtard in the States is kind of middle of the road in the context of UK politics. It's really something to behold. I don't quite understand how it got like how, I mean, I understand, you know, yes, you know, this was decided upon at Dresden, but the road from 1945 to now in the context of UK politics is not as clear to me. Maybe if we have some British listeners, you can help explain that to me, because I don't get it.
I think a lot of it's like having a aristocratic party. Like the Tories are like they're an aristocratic party, and like the lineage of that, I think, lends itself to being subverted more so than like, you know, non-aristocratic. Aristocratic parties are always kind of shitty, right? Like historically,
yeah.
And when you see one, like, I mean, it's funny because the electorate is extremely far right. Compared to the U.S.,
Brexit won, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
right.
Kind of all you need to know.
Well, no, also every single Tory elected since who came after Blair?
I don't remember the first.
I don't think
came after Blair.
Whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
I think including him, but maybe not him. Every single Tory prime minister and every single election has promised not like reductions. They've promised like zero.
Right. Yeah. Well. Yeah. And Blair himself was like on paper.
Yeah. On paper.
Yeah.
Basically, so they're consistently told tell the electorate we're going to do zero, like
zero net immigration.
I think Johnson said something like in a, I think, or he said something like less than 1,000 people would come in.
Something like that.
And, and it's always like, oh, we tell them a million, you know, it'd be common. And then, like, then they start talking about like, the Commonwealth, and, well, you don't include Pakistanis in that, because they speak, it's like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
Specifically requested the opposite of this, you know, it's like, it's you know, obviously, you know, it's you get, but also the UK, throwing the UK military is that they don't have the scale to cover the issues. So the U.S., can
just throw money, but
can throw money at it. They can fake it. Yeah. They also have like a million guys, and we don't have enough artillery to like fully equip every, you know, at, we probably couldn't, you know, obviously I think that they probably gonna see some reorganization after this war about how much artillery you need.
That's a, well, that, we'll, and oh, let's get we, to that in a second. Yeah. Let's get to that in a second.
But like, we Americans, we could fake it. We could send like 200,000 guys with that level of artillery right now. We just reassign some stuff, move some things around, and we're good. The Brits can't. They have like 10 divisions. You know, it's like, that's not even, even if they were ready for the task. It's like, it's 10 divisions. Like, the entire British military might deploy in support of Ukraine.
It wouldn't do,
It would extend the war another 6 months max.
Right.
You know, and not change the outcome. Because, just because the numbers aren't there.
I think the, well, maybe, okay, maybe we can just transition, because I don't know how much else there is to say other than how ludicrous that is. Well, maybe just one last thought, which is the UK university, as bad as the American university system is, the UK university system is even worse in terms of just the absolute insanity at every level and in control. And because I guess the UK doesn't really have the equivalent of the kind of like land grant regional university where you can kind of just to some extent keep your head down and do good work, and you know, you have enough, like, you know, local white kids from small or small-ish towns
that, it's like high school plus in the U.S. High school plus, like, yeah, you can get in, it's not a
right,
and they're huge,
and they're, yeah, and it's big enough, and that, and you know, and there's enough of a focus on like on technical knowledge that you can kind of just get by, at least for now. I mean, that's changing, and it's less every day, but that does exist in the U.S. It does not exist in the U.K. It's top down. Every single university is basically equivalent to, you know, whatever, Cal State, whatever, or the Ivy Leagues, in terms of just the sheer ideological insanity. And I don't know. It's very sad. And I can't wait for, to continue the transition in the topics, I think that highlights how, you know, we've discussed before on this program, I think, the like, what is the United Nations Security Council, right? It's the victor's table at World War II at Potsdam. So you can understand, like, to this day, why, you know, the United States, former USSR, now Russia, and China are all at the victor's table, right? France never demilitarized. Increasingly, you know, they're not only didn't denuclearize, but they increased the size and scope of their force. They have recently gotten kicked out of Mali. That's a kind of underappreciated story, something I haven't seen reported so much in the Western press. Is
it's in the French press a lot.
I bet. I haven't checked the French press recently, but the French have gotten kicked out of Mali, and the Russians are taking over, which is actually kind of a huge geopolitical story. But regardless, it's one of those things. Okay, yes, the French are losing some of their grip in Africa.
Well, they have ground to lose, right?
The British have nothing, and that's, I think, to me, what's underlying a lot of the specifically Russia oriented hysteria in the UK media, and the kind of, like, if you look at who's driving a lot of this, you know, we've made fun of Liz Truss on this program and on the Third Rail, et cetera, before. You know, the UK foreign minister, who's now first or second in line. She's a good, very good chance of becoming
PM. She's like one of only two whites in the running.
She's the only white in the running at this point. Yeah, the other is there's two Tory candidates. One is a Pajit. The other is Liz fucking Truss, who is
yes, the aristocracy. Yeah.
Well, and she is the Jewish neocon warmonger class pick. Like, she is this dumb fucking broad who is foaming at the mouth about Russia. Now, I don't know, like, what's underlying her. I mean, it doesn't really matter, obviously, either. But I think what's less in terms of her specifically, and more in terms of the kind of the British thing generally. I think this is some kind of play for relevance. This is like the last gasp, the truly the final gasp of, okay, I guess now we don't have an empire anymore. We have a commonwealth, but there's this pretense of relevance that this, you know, island in the middle of the North Atlantic has, you know, it bears some kind of continuity in terms of its ability to project power with what it was at the, you know, height of the Age of Sail. And that's just not true. It's not true at any level. And, you know, they ship, what was it? Like a couple of, what do they call them? Starscream missile systems? No, that's the Transformer. Starstreak. Whatever, like, it makes a fucking difference. Yeah. And these are like extreme short range, anti-air missile defense systems. This is not even the equivalent of like an S-300. It's just essentially point defense, for like the, you know, infantry that would be immediately in the vicinity.
It's between a Stinger and a serious thing. It's a good concept for an insurgency or a hybrid war. If this was 2014, it'd probably be a big fucking deal.
Right. But in the context of this conflict, it just is completely irrelevant. And that was like their big contribution, right?
Four HIMAR, or two. Something like two to four, I think they said like a handful. Yeah.
Do they produce them under license or what is
I think we sold them.
Or we sold them and then they were like reselling to them. Yeah, but it's just the piddly amount of equipment, you know, and just absolutely irrelevant in terms of like, and yet as you quite rightly just pointed out, even if they were to deploy the entire, you know, on the paper British military and 100% of everything they had and throw it into theater, just wouldn't do anything.
Yeah, you make the Russians send a little more, and the Russians are, oh fuck, we gotta call some more reservists, and
right.
You know,
it just wouldn't, and that, so this is, I think the it'll be interesting to see, because so much of what's happening, I think, at a kind of macro geopolitical level is essentially Putin and Xi together kind of saying like, yeah, you know, upsetting the apple cart of the post-World War II order, really kind of calling into question its foundation of like, okay, yes, we fought this big cataclysm.
Well, when is India and Pakistan both make a push for it? Because they are they're nuclear, bigger armies on paper.
You're talking about 2 billion people collectively with many, many nuclear weapons.
Yeah. And you can't bring one on the counter and not bring the other one because they're very hostile, right? Right. And in theory, I think the reason you keep them off the council is so you can mediate between the two, but like that kind of, they can also just not care, right?
I mean, when has the UN ever really like prevented, you know? Yeah. Well, the UN clearly is useless. And there's one of the kind of hot stories of the moment is this one of the, I think it's the single largest nuclear power plant in Europe is the Zaporizhia plant in southern Ukraine that was recently taken over by the Russians. And then there's this kind of hilarious, media self-own where the Russians took over the plant and then there's explosion, you know, the plant comes under artillery fire. And so they're in this insane position of having to try to claim and with the official Ukrainian claim that they're coming under fire from themselves, essentially. That Russia is shelling themselves in this.
Also, there was another thing that Russia was using. Like, the Ukraine thing, the Ukrainian is like, propaganda thing is very sloppy because they were making multiple claims. One was that they were using the artillery, or the theoretical artillery. You wouldn't fire rounds near this thing, in theory. And Russia was moving tanks and transport around this area, like, using it as a human, kind of a human shield, but like a nuclear human shield. And then there's like, also Russians are shelling it.
Right.
But it's definitely not us, but there's definitely troops there that are Russian. It's like,
and then like just the other day, Zelensky said like, oh, well, if there's Russian troops that are using it as a position, then we're going to attack them, you know? Yeah. And it's just like, you get your messaging straight. But the UN was, you know, ineffectually trying to be like, give it back, guys. Give it back to Ukraine. We can just have a demilitarized zone around it. Just give it back to Ukraine.
What's funny is the Russians are probably fine with that, but they know that
it was just not. Yeah, not it was happen. Actually demilitarized, maybe, right? Yeah. But it's just not gonna how that would go. But I mean, the thing that struck me about that was, I mean, apart from the kind of intrinsic hilarity of the UN making just completely ineffectual demands, the thing is, one of the few areas where the UN is actually not a joke is in terms of the International Atomic Energy Agency and anything related to nuclear power, nuclear weapons. You know, OGs will recall that it wasn't until the Americans like essentially went to the UN nuclear wing in the early 2000s and made the case specifically about Saddam having specifically nuclear, like nobody gave a shit about these biological chemical stockpiles, but nuclear weapons is one of these things where people actually, except for Israel, right? Israel can do whatever the fuck it wants. But for the rest of the world, it's one of these things where there is actually kind of a consensus in terms of enforcement. And yet even that was unable to do anything about it. Now, obviously, I think it's at a certain level, it's because, and Russia even said, like, please, UN inspectors, please come and see exactly what's happening at this plant.
Well, they've been calling that, they've been demanding
that over and over again.
Well, they've been demanding inspectors come to Donetsk for all these kinds of, like, Russia is doing very similar to what Germany did. They are basically like when they called in the Swiss for the invasion of Poland, when they found all these like mass graves the Russians or the Russians caused. They are you can if like if
please they, Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks did.
Yeah. Are you,
Anyway.
Oh, we're doing this now? Yeah. My check didn't clear this month, so no, but, so like if you can rules lawyer like the democratic powers all day in their own thing and they'll never cover it. But like if you go back, you know, Hitler demanded a plebiscite under Versailles. You're supposed to give plebiscites.
Right.
And like all these things. Well, if you're not giving a plebiscite, I have the right. Same thing with Donbass, right?
Yeah.
I demand. We demand.
Same thing with Crimea, frankly. Like, yeah, exactly.
Demand a plebiscite. Well, if you're not going to recognize it or, you know, give it to us, well, then look.
Unfortunately, you are no longer in. You have now abrogated this treaty. And so fuck you.
And, you know, that's how it is. Like the West is like kind of it's kind of a house built on sand. No one really takes these treaties seriously, except for when it's convenient, and everybody's kind of always known that it was a happy fiction.
Well, it was a fiction undergirded by the unchallenged myth.
As Max Book says, the U.S. is a military hyperpower.
Yes,
hyperpower,
not a superpower. A hyperpower alone, you know, unipolarity is the and that's of course this unchallenged up until February 22nd, 2022, unchallenged myth of global American essentially military invincibility,
which is already being gut checked by the Iranians all day and you know all kinds of, and. But yeah, now it's like
now
conventional
it's
war.
Yeah.
That was always the cope, was that, well, in conventional war, no. You know, it's like you have to actually like, send troops to conventional wars, right? Like, you know, you don't know how many Americans would it take to like stem the tide in Ukraine?
Probably the
200,000 to 400,000,
something like that. I mean, I would expect,
and including and like also a nationalization or like a Americanization of the
They're already, from what I understand, they're now basically admitting that they're at least the intelligence and targeting operations are essentially just straight up being run by the Americans. But there's been rumors for a long time that command and control is also being run by Americans. I don't think that would surprise anyone. But yeah, it would be formal, I think, at that point, formalized and. I mean, I don't think that's really.
It's not realistic, not but like, it's interesting. Like, what would it take to?
Yeah, that's what it would take. Yeah, frankly, yeah, is probably 200,000 to 400,000 American boots on the ground of very, not
from
just,
all armed services,
exactly. Yeah,
not just Army,
like and full commitment, and probably which would mean a wartime economy in the United States, and
I think we could get away with it. We've been putting them on the credit card for a while. It would crater your recruitment getting fucked though. Holy shit.
Well, you'd have to draft probably. I mean, you'd have, and then you'd have draft. I mean, again,
you'd have, there's like, we could do it. I think you could do things like you activate every single National Guardsman for the duration.
Oh God. Could you imagine how pissed off they'd be?
Yeah. which is, start stop lossing guys again,
man.
It's not happening.
No, which is like, I mean, that's the interesting thing to me is, I don't know, I'm not in the business of making predictions. I'm an analyst, I look at systems, and so it's less about, which is to say, I guess I've been overly, if you want to call it, optimistic about Russia's ability to get this wrapped up quickly. Frankly, I think that was less about underestimating.
I want to talk about this, like the whole thing, because we obviously predicted that we end over faster and it's still going, right?
Right.
Obviously. And I think we got like kind of fooled. I think it's kind of come out. I don't know. There's like the whole Kiev Gambit bit.
Yeah.
Which is like a very Russian thing to do because they love chess.
Well, you have to.
It's literally like, I have a case to make for it.
Yeah.
It's like also not only was it like it was like a multi-process. Obviously, there was a threat that Ukraine would just collapse immediately and they just roll in and take it. Also, like, it's like almost in terms of like a very Catholic or Aquinas or Augustinian, just war theory. Yeah. You have to do it because the risk, like, the cost of it being a failure or not that I think it's a route or anything.
So far outweighed by the possibility of benefits.
Or just like the lack of human suffering had the war ended.
Can you imagine? Right, exactly. Yeah, if the Kiev regime had collapsed in the first, like, whatever, 90 something hours of the war, you know, like they make this push from the north, they surround Kiev, the military's like, you know what, we can't win this war, which they can't, they never could, they never would. You know, and as a result of that initial essentially decision to fight as hard as they possibly could, now we have all this death and destruction. But had they made the right choice, the wise choice at that time, and just decided to submit, like, yeah, all this essentially could have been avoided, or the, you know, 95% plus of it, probably more than that, frankly. I mean, yeah. You know, think about like how it would have looked if this had been over on March 1st.
Yeah. And now you can also make the case that they should have not even reinforced Donbass and just made that the primary spearhead of...
Are you talking about Russia?
Yeah, like you can argue Russia should have just minimal reinforcements in the Donbass and then sell out, go, you know, instead of doing a feint.
Oh, just do like a hardcore... Yeah, making
that the focus of operations as opposed to...
Yeah, but that would have been extremely... I mean, again, this is like a war gaming this out, like who knows? Yeah.
And I think Russia is doing a thing where they are essentially trying to prove to the population of Russia that they're a superpower, which means... You don't have to do a draft. You don't have to. We're trying to prove that we are as good as the Americans at this. We can maybe not win a war in like, you know, a month, but we can. But
they're also not fighting goat herders.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's the thing. Is like Ukrainians are European. Like also European powers are just intrinsically harder to deal with, on multiple levels.
Yeah.
But part of being a big superpower is that you don't need to call a draft for a war. That's arguably like the qualifications. We can do a whole war without
a whole ass war
without a draft
against essentially a peer opponent with an equally matched people get, I think, confused about this a little bit because there's so much CIA American misinformation flying around. Troops in theater on both sides. Well, now it's probably the balance is starting to shift just because of the scale of the losses on the Ukrainian side, but. Even given that, it's basically equal balance of forces. It's okay. There's an artillery. There's
arguably a manpower advantage to the Ukrainians that's negated by them not being mobile,
and then not having artillery and air support to the extent that the Russians do. That's definitely a qualitative difference in the composition of forces. But in terms of manpower, if anything, Ukraine may have a slight advantage, to more than slight advantage. And they have their own extensive artillery. I've seen I don't know if it was Rebar or one of these it was some kind of Russian account on Telegram basically making a summation point that, you know, again, I'm not in a position to independently evaluate this. I guess is this OSINT? Are we fair to call ourselves OSINT rather than, you know, this is all you know, we're examining and evaluating. At some point we're gonna have to have a discussion about intelligence services and intelligence operations generally. I
found some. Speaking of OSINT, I just wanted. Apparently, I read some book years when I was like in high school. It was at the CIA, just in like the Cold War, and it said the most reliable, most like the best intel gathering they ever did through the entire Cold War was they bribed a guy, an East German, to buy all the newspapers that were for sale in East Berlin and just
send them to
him.
Send
them to him by via, like, it was needlessly complex.
Sure.
But there was like some way of him basically dead dropping all the newspapers every day.
Yeah, it was just a version of OSINT,
and that's how they got
the
vast majority of their intelligence and reporting.
Right. So in any case, I'm you know, take it for what it may be worth, but I think it ticks a lot of boxes and makes a lot of sense that essentially what he was describing is there are effectively two Ukrainian armies. The one is the professional service as it existed prior to the outbreak of hostilities built up by NATO over the 8 years since the Maidan coup. This is extremely artillery focused. These people are, highly professionalized, highly competent. And those are the ones who are actually doing the damage to the Russians. Then, and they're about something like 20% of the forces at most. Then on the other side is about 80% fresh conscripts, territorial defense, National Guard, etc., whose job is to sit and get shot at so that the professional artillerymen can do counter-battery fire. And that's like how the exchange goes is, and that's why you see all these, you know, if you've been paying attention to the Russian Telegram channels, et cetera, you'll see a lot of aerial footage, drone footage, et cetera, of, Ukrainian, just like old men. It's really sad, but whatever. Anyway, just, it's just these old guys and, sitting in a trench getting blown up or, you know, getting shot at by artillery, just completely helpless, doing nothing. But once they're getting shot at, then the damage dealing wing, whatever you call the DPS, portion of the Ukrainian army can then shoot back and theoretically deal some damage, and that's also part of why it's taking so long is because it's the Russians have adopted a strategy of just being very careful.
Also, they seem to they have gone very World War II with the ground taken being secondary versus army destruction.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, it's good doctrine. It's just...
Yeah, just, you know?
Yeah. Well, it just... And it does seem that... I mean, and everything that the Jew Zelensky government has been saying is... I mean, they had a hilarious statement the other... It was within the past week. That they're not going to negotiate because negotiating would essentially mean surrender.
Yeah.
which is like, I mean, again, a kind of funny admission.
And there has been speculation that there's like ceasefire talks in the works. The talks from the especially from the Russian side that they're talking about it. But the reason was given for both sides want to, just rebuild two fight in a month. Like it was a ceasefire,
right.
Ceasefire
not, actually yeah.
not an armistice, like a literal ceasefire,
right? Which is going to accomplish nothing, right? I mean, what is that gonna do?
Yeah. So speaking of analysts, there's, if you want to follow the war play by blow by blow play by play, there's only really one good analyst on the entire thing, I think, who's like actually neutral. It's a YouTube and Twitter account called, and I think that, I don't know if they have Telegram, but Defense Politics Asia.
Oh, okay.
The guy is a Singaporean, like former conscript. He has, I don't think, any formal training, but he's just good at filtering like
all the bullshit
on both sides.
Yeah,
and he does a thing where he has an updating like a live map of the front line, and he finds like determining where the front line actually is to be the most important thing, if you will.
Sure.
That'll make a strong case. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And he had some great posts where because Ukraine has their own like official mapping service, and there was this post where they have like their own front line where they determine it, and they also track Russian artillery strikes and Russian missile strikes, and they had like every single Russian missile strike and artillery strike in a line like 10 kilometers behind their declared front line. It's like, so do you think that's the real front line, or do you think it's
right? Yeah. Man, that's the I think one of the again, taking a kind of step back and looking at it from a different angle, the interesting, depressing, heartening for various different reasons thing about this war is the like with the nuclear power plant, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant situation. You know, you have Ukraine flags in their bio who simultaneously believe that you basically believe that Russia is shelling themselves, right? And
which is actually an old propaganda point from Donetsk.
They were
from
Donetsk, the same
2014.
Thing. Yeah. They were doing the same thing this time, though. They did the same thing with the Kramatorsk missile. They did the same similar things with a bunch of stuff. So, How do you hold all these different things in your mind at the same time? I've never understood. It's not how my mind works, I guess. I saw I saw today actually. I don't know if I just hadn't noticed it before because it's a route that I don't infrequently take. But I saw a Ukraine flag with a sunflower. I presume a reference to this obviously like intelligence agency planted service story about was it the Russian grandma, the Ukrainian grandma,
yeah, gave the soldier the official flower of Ukraine.
Is that the flower? Is that,
apparently, I didn't, it's like their official flower.
Everybody gave the sunflower seeds and like you're gonna die and then you're gonna sprout up from your corpse.
Yeah,
and like how do people believe this shit? I don't know.
What's funny is like that has a very different meaning for the Russians.
I'm not aware of this.
So the base level, like, oh, we're fucked rations for the Red Army in World War II were sunflower seeds. And you'd get like in a burlap sack for like, oh, this is your rations for the next 2 days. Wow. Which is like, you know, like, it's like,
that sends a, yeah, the wrong message.
Yeah,
then,
it's like, I guess,
sure.
It's yeah. Like, you know, so it's funny how like those kind of symbols are kind of crossed.
I didn't know that. That's really funny. Yeah.
You know, like, it's like one of those memes, like, we don't have rifles. It's like, also, we don't eat, all we have to eat is burlap sunflower sacks full of sunflower seeds. Mm. You know, which I'm sure was awful and shitty.
But yeah, I just keep waiting for the other shoe to drop in terms of like, when are these people going to have to face reality? And it keeps getting deferred. And, you know, I mean, there's maybe it just keeps getting deferred, you know, past the midterms, past the 2024 elections, and they just move on to the next, you know, the new, what is it? The new thing, the new topic. I can't remember the
next,
meme.
Next thing.
Yes. Regardless.
Or what is it? Current thing.
Current thing. And thank then, you. There's yeah, another current.
There's a new current thing.
There's a new current thing. And then, you know, everybody forgets.
Well, it's monkeypox, right? That's the new current thing. Monkeypox is the new current
thing. Fuck, man. Yeah.
So I don't want to change the gears too hard.
No, it's more fine. We're kind of done. Yeah.
It's a freewheeling episode. Sure. So I want to just get this out there. It's non-lethal.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. It will not kill you. It will not kill anybody. Don't care. If you're like...
Yeah,
the worst, most degenerate
faggot.
Yeah, it's like he's not gonna kill you. Like, so why are we?
Because it's a faggot disease.
Well, it's one of these things. It's not. Cause, like, faggot disease kill you in theory, right? That's like the whole point is that like AIDS was killing you,
right? But I think
you cannot do like the it's just like a new AIDS if you're not dying. Your dick hurts for 2 weeks. You have it burns
like,
when you
faggot. But are you kidding? Like for faggots, that's like worse than death.
No, it's not. Because that's shit. You think like general warts don't burn their way around there every
fuck? I don't want to
quarterly
think about
on a quarterly oh, basis. No. There's not like a it, oh it burns oh. when you pee. You're gay. It burns when you pee. It's part of the deal. You want to have unprotected sex with a bunch of guys? It's like God. Oh yeah. Oh wow. It burns when you pee. Wow.
Yeah, I think this is another great example of this kind of double thing of like it. It's a crisis because it's a faggot disease and it affects faggots and therefore that's the worst thing. But simultaneously, like, it's not just a faggot disease and it's a threat to everyone.
But we won't take any countermeasures because right. countermeasures would imply a certain level.
It's just retarded. I don't know. I mean, well, you know, yeah, it's hopefully it just burns itself out because
this happens quarterly. You get a novel strand, it burns itself out because luckily they have an excellent evolutionary, whatever you want to call it, mechanism where if you spread a disease around your community so fast,
right.
it just burns out and right. it's gone.
Yeah.
An insular community can do that with a rapidly. That's why AIDS is actually so devastating, because AIDS is not rapidly spreading. It requires like 100 exposures or whatever the I haven't read the Salah forum in a while. I haven't read the thread. But apparently it requires like 50 to 100 exposures to actually contract it. Which means that you don't get that rapid burnout effect you get with, say, a monkeypox or
you just have to,
genital
like,
warts.
Do 50 degenerate,
yeah,
anonymous.
Just increase your...
Oh, well, that brings us... Okay, so I actually wanted to talk about this a little, because I actually mentioned this on post, but it kind of got buried in a bunch of health thread bullshit that I don't want to talk about. But okay, so there was this thing going around, because while we're on the topic of faggots and, like, you know, I guess it's a general roundup. So... You saw this thing about the Shota, I don't actually know how to, is it Shota shot? I guess it's Japanese.
I think it's Shota, but I've never asked somebody who,
right.
I never asked a native speaker for some reason.
Right.
Never came up.
So there's, you know, with the paper of the dude who jerks off to Shota porn. You don't know this?
No, I'm familiar with I've been on the internet. I know what the word means. But.
Okay. So, oh shit. So then we actually do have to, because this was, and I don't think the TDS guys have covered this either. So, so there was this, I think he's in the UK, that doesn't have an immediately Jewy sounding last name, but you never know, I guess. But I'm going to assume he's actually like native, you know, he's British or English. In any case, he's a PhD student in the I don't know what there's gender studies, let's call it, or equivalent, but it doesn't fucking
call them studies.
Studies.
Yeah.
Grievance studies. Yes.
Yeah.
Department. So he, and I actually read the paper. So this actually caused a minor stir because there was this
it because it was so well written and professionally done?
In fact, no. So what happened was, as I recall the sequence of events, it was actually kind of under the radar for a couple months. And then it was brought to the attention of Twitter.
You're saying it was like a flare-up kind of?
Precisely. That's the best way to describe it.
Like a
red pustules kind of emerging all of a sudden.
Well, it was there for longer than you thought, but then, it really...
All of a sudden, it really kind of, So this, I believe it was a Tory MP, made a tweet about, like, basically why are British taxpayers funding this dude's research? Because he's gets a stipend. He's essentially paid. I mean, it's not glamorous, but you do get essentially you get free tuition and a stipend to live on as a PhD student at whatever. It wasn't Oxford or Cambridge, I don't think. It was one of these sort of lesser known universities. Not that matters too much. In any case, the paper. Well, so the Tory MP is like, this dude is getting paid by the British taxpayers to jerk off to child porn or whatever, manga child porn.
Doujins, I believe.
Doujin. I don't fucking...
Once again, I never ask a native speaker because I would never ask a native speaker these questions.
Yeah, and he's like, what the fuck is up with that? He gets attacked by the Twitter tranny brigade who are like all...
Oh, is this guy a tranny?
No, he's a Tory. He's gay. He's a faggot.
So there was an instinctive response with the tranny brigade to defend
the faggot. Yes.
Yeah. Wow, funny.
Yeah. So he's a faggot, and he leap to his defense, but then people actually start like reading the paper, and everybody's immediately grossed out, and the paper actually gets taken down. It's no longer on. It was published in Sage, and it's no longer on Sage. You can still find it quite easily. I found it. I read it, and so I'll relay. Maybe we could do a little bit. I mean, you want to filibuster for a second so I can? Yeah. The
hard to shift gears off of it. That's not too far.
All right. Let me see if I.
I can. Yeah. So, I would say that the trannyism is arguably okay. The reason they might have come to defense outside of rainbow flag solidarity is because trannyism is intrinsically tied up with sexual anime. Being a tranny almost requires being an anime fan. It's one of those things. It's necessary but not predictive. You can't use anime fandom to predict somebody's a tranny, but you can use somebody being a tranny he's an anime. Yeah,
right. Okay, so I found the paper. This is the title is "I Am Not Alone - We Are All Alone : this big colon there.
Colon report.
talk about a colon report. Yeah. Using masturbation as an ethnographic method in research on Shota subculture in Japan. Abstract. I wanted to understand how my research participants
Real quick, back up. What is ethnography? And
ethnography is what you call anthropology now, because anthropology is colonialist as
a
term.
Good. So I just wanted to. So this is anthropology.
This is anthropology, but you can't call it anthropology anymore. You call it
no, but it's via masturbation. So arguably a return to the British sense of what they. arguably, if you read certain books, a return to what the British were doing in certain parts of the world.
Yes. So, abstract. I wanted to understand how my research participants experience sexual pleasure while reading Shota, a Japanese genre of self-published erotic comics that features young boy characters. I therefore started reading the comics in the same way as my research participants had told me that they did it, while masturbating. In this research note, I will recount how I set up an experimental method of masturbating to Shota comics and how this participant observation of my own desire not only gave me a more embodied understanding of the topic for my research, but also made me think about loneliness and ways to combat it as driving forces of the culture of self-published erotic comics.
So this all started when somebody like said, oh, I'm going to build a fire. I found like a Paleolithic tools for building a fire and built a fire. And like liberalism is twisted, like, oh, I'll use like this bow and saw method to build a fire, just like the caveman, understand, which is like, okay, that's very valid. And like, okay, how effective is this really, you know? And, you know, dot, 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 you know, question mark, question mark, question mark. I'm watching child pornography.
Right. And he goes, he goes like he has a long, well, so, okay. So
anthropologists used to carry guns.
Yeah. They were like, I mean, those like early 20th century guys, I mean, say whatever you want. I mean, a lot of them were Jewish.
You used to, like, actually, you have to request from the consulate, like, I need 20 infantrymen.
Yes.
If you can spare them. And they usually could for some bizarre reason. Like, they always had.
Well, they had their colonial reasons for wanting to know more about the internal structure.
I'm going to Afghanistan. I need. Yeah. Can I have 20 redcoats? Or I'm going to go like to study the languages. Like, oh,
yeah. Sure. Done. Here.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Right. That's what you use Gurkhas for, right? All that kind of like.
Yeah.
Local guides / fighters that are loyal to you. You know.
Yeah. So he said I had hit a wall in my research. Blah blah blah. He goes through. He describes Shota, what that is, and what is it? Lolicon, a genre that features young girl characters in an sexually explicit way. And so I guess he talks about a little bit the difference between Shota and Loli. And this is again very serious academic research that demands to be taken seriously. My eye was first really caught when I was reading this. There's the first is the introduction, then there's the subheading Erotic Confessions. Quote, the erotic in research ranges from recognizing it as a benevolent influence in education to anthropologists having sex with research participants in order to understand a certain practice, such as anonymous sex. But there's
a mysterious practice.
I was like, okay, what the fuck? So
yes, the esoteric of
so
as if you can't just ask them, like,
so there are two.
I was infiltrating the bathhouse.
That's literally okay. So like,
I know that's actually jumping happened. Ahead. People have done PhDs on that, but so, that's just
so the there's two references here. One is, and I was like benevolent influence in education. I'm like trying to understand what that could mean. So I tracked down the paper that he cites. That paper is a woman who misspells a word on the. I forget what she said on the first, but it was basically like it was a really glaring, ignorant grammatical error, like on literally the first page of the thing. And the whole article is about how she uses AOL Instant Messenger, because this was written in 2009, to talk to the undergraduates that she's teaching, and how she has like flirty conversations with a couple of them who like ask her out on dates. And she kind of like, it's unclear the extent to which she claims that she's intellectually attracted to one of them and physically attracted to the other, but not that much.
That's really gay.
It's extreme. It was like literally Dear Diary of, and I guess the class was nominally in, as I recall, communications or some bullshit, you know, non-subject like that. So it's not even like
a real. I took a communication class once. Okay. I gave a presentation on a music video.
Right. Yeah, exactly. This is the level of right. So I bet you did. So but anyway, so that's what the paper on the benevolent influence of eroticism in education was about. The other one was written in 2019, and this is a paper that's also is essentially the related to a dissertation by this.
Well, yeah, I have a question. She so declared her research benevolent. Or was he declaring her?
He declared it.
Okay, because that's like I was fucking a
she
student.
Was actually, her paper was a little more, and it was sort of like, it was more about like examining the phenomenon of this quasi-erotic relationship between teacher and student as a kind of like personal interaction, but not, her paper ended, she had like kind of analytic sections and kind of Dear Diary sections. It ended with a Dear Diary section about how she would continue, she like felt guilty about having these flirty DM conversations with her students, but she kept doing it anyway. Like that's how that paper ended.
Oh, so yes.
It's not like unambiguously benevolent.
Anthropology.
Right? Yeah. But the other one,
I like the language of this Indian kingdom so much, we invaded. Yeah. You know, it's an old tradition, you know. I've composed this dictionary, and we've deployed a division.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we really need to figure out how this conch shell based economy. Like, yeah. How does that? We really, it's very important. Let's send a.
What if we introduced gunpowder? Yeah. Would they shift to using that as a currency?
Let's find out. So the other one was this. I couldn't tell if he was Mexican or Spanish or what, but some kind of Spanish speaking faggot who went to different like anonymous sex spots, like glory, like, well, part of it was, it wasn't just glory holes, it was mainly actually outdoor, like on hiking trails,
yeah,
type spots, and describing the kind of like I guess the secret symbols that faggots use to anonymously have sex with each other.
Ah, yes, he learned this.
He kind of admitted that he didn't learn it, that he like already knew it. Like, yeah. The way he framed it was, I was familiar with this phenomenon. I had had anonymous sex before, but I hadn't been cruising neither in these specific spots before, nor in this particular kind of like absolutely anonymous way.
Ah, the scientific method, yes.
And that's where he was going with it, was like, yeah. Like, now we're going to study this anthropologically with myself as a participant observer. I'm going to participate in like being a disgusting degenerate faggot in this particular way. Like, I'm a disgusting degenerate faggot, but I hadn't quite like sunk to these particular depths before.
Also, just a note for a lot of guys don't understand this. Hiking is a sexual thing. Like, you go hiking with a girl to have sex with her in the process of hiking.
Right.
And guys like don't get that a lot. Like, no, that's a thing. Like, it's like a sex, like hiking is like not for sex. There's a sport elements to it and competitive, but like if you take a girl hiking, it's implied that you're going to have sex with her at some point.
Right.
And she's gonna be like cool with it.
Right.
That's like,
that's a thing. Yes.
Yeah. And like, can we not give them this? Like, also like,
you ruin nature. I mean,
but also just waiting in it's not how you do it. You take a girl there. You don't like wait in ambush for another faggot. It's like it's not how this works. Yeah. You want to go hiking. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. So, So that's why, I mean, I was saying, I was like, okay, well, a lot of people it was briefly, and it's still kind of making the rounds, but it was really quite a stir on Twitter for a while of this story about this faggot who wrote this paper about jerking off to little boys.
Fictional. They're all 1,000 years old.
Yeah. Is that a cope for, I know that's a, I'm actually not familiar enough with this genre to.
I doubt it. Yeah.
I don't think they're like all like actually 1,000 years old.
I think they are. If you ask the author.
Yeah, right. Sure. Anyway, yeah. So like the paper itself is gross enough. I think we mainly covered the. At one point, he acknowledged it. He's like, oh yeah, I. Well, I actually want to give him too much credit. I don't want to keep reading this bullshit. I was mainly struck by how. Like the problems in this paper, as far as taxpayer funding of just disgusting shit that should never be done, far less written about, is like he has a bunch of citations in his paper that are arguably worse.
Yeah, I mean that's how it,
you know, like it's just kind of funny. So yeah, I don't remember how we got. Oh yeah, monkeypox. That's how all these people. It's unfortunate that they can't die from monkeypox.
Yeah, but like also then why do I give a shit?
Right.
In theory, like, yes, if every faggot died, that would be, like, a news story. Or,
right.
Yeah, or was at risk. But also, you know, they didn't stop this stuff for COVID. Like,
yeah, a lot of people making that point, and it's like, a great one. It's like, well, you know, people weren't allowed, still aren't allowed. Still, in many places, not allowed. You can't visit your dying grandparent. You can't, you know.
Hospitals are still weird.
But faggots, you know, get unlimited, you know, the human right of faggots to like fill in the blanks is just absolutely inviolable, and we can't can't do anything about that might impinge upon.
And we fought a war over it, so it makes sense.
I mean, Dresden.
Yeah, this was decided at Dresden.
Yes,
yeah.
This was decided at Dresden. That faggots get to. This was very the absolute pinnacle of civilization.
I'm making a terrible joke. That's the tragedy of Alan Turing. It's because he enabled this all, but he never got to enjoy it because he couldn't, you know? He still had to deal with, like, he never, the man essentially, like, you know, and all those guys in
Bletchley Park.
Yeah, Bletchley Park. Basically enabled, you know, they could do whatever they wanted. You know, infinite homosexual encounters, but they themselves never got to enjoy it. And, you know, isn't that a...
This is a world historical tragedy.
Yeah, you know, it's like... Foucault did. So Foucault got, you know.
He died of AIDS, right?
Yeah. He got there, though. Like,
yeah,
you know,
but he actually, yes, he did. He got died of AIDS because he
got to the mountaintop. Yeah, he got to the, he got to the mountaintop. And the, he, like,
the little boy.
Yeah.
Mountaintop. Yes. That's enough of that. That's more than enough of that. Jesus. That's what I'm saying. Like, please, Daddy Putin, please.
Yeah.
Like,
ooh.
You can end it. We can end it here. We can end it for all time.
Yeah. I guess we're done with the Nancy Pelosi and Taiwan bit, but it's kind of over and done at a certain point.
Well, that particular angle of it is done. I don't think the story is over by any stretch.
Yeah. Russia, I mean, China is now going to be like, oh, well, I guess we're doing this now, you know?
I don't see, I mean, the U.S. Navy can't keep its ships from crashing into each other. Like, I
think there will be a point where we have to, like, acknowledge that PACOM is, like, also, it's both, like, incompetent and too small for its job anyway. Kind of,
yeah.
You should, like, it's kind of a gut check. Like, all right, so, you know, we left the Middle East. Let's reassign, the Indian Ocean fleet to PACOM and let the Brits handle the Indian Ocean or whatever, or someone, or, you know, make a, you know,
shit, let the mighty Russian Navy, like, exist for the first time.
Just, yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Wait, but also, I mean, the Chinese, like, the Chinese military is, like, the only thing they train for is, like, this.
Right.
And
well, they do something like the India thing. Like, yeah. The Himalayan.
Well, they actually, they have what's called, I want to say, the Western or the Mountain. So they do the thing in military districts that, like, the Russians did with, like, Western military, all these So there's basically a mountain command, and that's all they do. And they actually have different, like, squad structure.
Wow.
They're totally different. It's like, wow. It's just made for...
Just for that.
For that, yeah. The India stuff. And I think they kind of silo that off. Like, so it doesn't... Because it's a totally different way of fighting, and it's kind of...
Sure.
It's like also, like, you don't kind of infect the rest of your force, and it's also, like, very low tech. Because you're just...
They were literally fighting with sticks. I mean, that was, like, a kind of skirmish.
Like, you can't, at high altitudes, you can't be running on tanks and things. It's a totally different doctrine.
Yeah,
I believe they use... it's been a while since I looked into it. Like, the regular Russian Chinese squad or platoons, they use... It's based around, like, grenade launchers, automatic grenade launchers, instead of, like, a traditional, like, Western we use, like, machine guns in the squads and the... to argue about the riflemen. They use automatic grenade launchers, but not in the mountain warfare because you need the range... of a, you know, the PKM equivalent. So, like, they have a totally different structure at all kinds of levels. So they to prevent, like, that. It's like a separate, like, it's like, you said stuff like, we have, like, it's like the, imagine it's like the Border Patrol was, like,
sure,
a military wing, right. You know,
which it should be. But yeah, well, that's what I was going to say, actually, to bring the focus back on, like, the American side of things for a minute is, you know, in a non-clown world, you could see the logic of, like, okay, fine, China gets the Western Pacific. Frankly, India has nuclear submarines. They can patrol their own borders. There's no reason why they shouldn't have control over their own waters, whatever. Pull the American fleet back to the Eastern Pacific, you know, California coast.
Plus, we have, like, the Iran bullying fleet isn't really...
It's
over. Like,
they're done.
Iran won. Iran's not getting invaded anytime soon. Everybody knows it.
Yeah.
It's just not gonna
ever. I mean, how would that happen?
Yeah,
you know, like, just... again, Putin has done a checkmate in the Middle East as well. I guess this, maybe we can another time maybe discuss.
I want to shift to Legos.
Maybe you want
to, because we did a Lego. We come back to a lot of topics we covered.
Sure,
Legos. You found like an exploit for getting cool Legos. Apparently, right?
I mentioned before the show started, there's a highly recommended, actually, if you like spaceships or
it's got a Power Ranger kind of vibe to it.
There's a program called the Monkey Kid, which I've actually never seen. It's some kind of joint Chinese Lego thing. I don't actually really 100% understand or pretend to understand. It doesn't matter. Got rad as fuck spaceship. Was like, I guess nobody, because it didn't really catch on with the Western audience. So Legos, like, never go on sale. They're absurd. I wouldn't exactly say overpriced, but they're definitely pricey.
I'll say it.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
But this one actually went on sale, and it's a super cool translucent red. It's kind of a throwback to '90s kids. Remember the what do they call it? With the
Mighty Morphin Power Rangers?
No. The Lego had a whole, like extra,
just the space
alien, the space
the translucent rock guys.
Yeah, with like the I don't remember the fucking names, but and like within the blue, the was
Space Cops.
Space Cops versus Black Tron. Yes, and that whole like era is very much a kind of throwback to that, and it's got super cool blaster launcher shit, and Siege Baby and I have been very much enjoying flying our Monkey Kid spaceship around. I think it's a kind of sci-fi-ish take on Journey to the West, is my understanding of you know, like Monkey Kid. You can see like the monkey thing, but like I don't fucking know who the minifigures are.
This is gonna be like Chinese characters. Dragon Ball in 10 years.
And we're yeah,
gonna, like,
pretty much.
You're gonna be out on the ground floor. You know?
Sure. Yeah.
You bought early.
I got in early. Got in. Yeah. No, it's a really cool set, and and we've been doing more kind of elaborate Legos recently. We also built the Lego globe. It's a lot of fun, and it actually, you know, it's interesting to see. I don't know. For me, at least, it's a kind of enough of a haven from the problems with product generally. Obviously, Lego, unfortunately, has had. I think they. What is it? There was some. There's. I think we discussed it even on the Lego episode. But there's been some like LGBT bullshit. But like nobody. The thing is, nobody buys it. Like all that shit. Like again, Lego stuff never goes on sale. They never reduce the price.
What do you think sells more in America? Monkey King or LGBT?
Definitely Monkey Kid. I could tell you like that's very clear.
Is it King or Kid?
Kid. Monkey Kid. And it's Monkie. Yeah. So if you like look for Monkey Kid spaceship. I think it's Galactic Explorer or something was the actual. Now we're totally nerding out, but it was fine. It was actually, and it had like I just love also the and of course Siege Baby also loves the spring loaded blasters. Just, yeah. Mrs. DK not as much of a fan.
No, really. So speaking of the tragedy of this conflict, Russian children have been denied Lego.
I saw that.
I want to check that.
Yeah,
Lego update.
Yeah,
they joined Warhammer 40K in the kind of luxury. Model ban, you know, the consortium apparently.
I feel way worse about the Lego ban than the 40K ban.
The Russians don't. The Russians really care about 40K. The Russians are obsessed with that shit.
But you could just 3D print that shit, right?
They already do to a certain degree. You can buy like recasts.
I was gonna say.
But like still, you know, it's
not the same.
It's not the same. I don't.
Legos are really not the same. The difference between
like
the Legos, the genuine Legos and knockoff Legos. Is huge. It's really, really noticeable and definitely. Like I tried to go that route. I was like, nah, this is not happening. But I feel like I guess I'm not a. Ironically, okay, maybe we can address the elephant in the room here. Like this is one of the things about because there's been the 40K wars on post for a while. Like I have never. I think I played one round of tabletop once. I don't think we finished all the way through. Never bought any 40K product that wasn't a video game. Particularly including miniatures or like rule books or any other, even like the non tabletop, like I know Horus Heresy has a boxed set game now. It sounds like fun. Maybe I will fucking buy it just to play it and have a good time, but I just haven't. Never pirated, even not haven't bought, but far I haven't even pirated.
I've done all those things.
You're the guy. The 40K books.
I have done all of. I have committed all those sins. I've both pirated and bought and read the books.
So maybe for people who are like on, because the post is like a hyper online. Yeah. Like, the people have this criticism of like, oh, 40, 40K is you know the Games Workshop hates you. Why are you supporting them? It's like A, I don't. B, like shut up. See, like, who cares?
Yeah. Are you telling me a company?
Right!
Doesn't support me?
Wow, really?
I didn't stop drinking because Anheuser-Busch was gay. I'm sorry. I buy more Yingling than I did before the Anheuser-Busch got gay. What do you want me to do? I'm sure there's a Pride Flag PBR out there somewhere. I'm still drinking PBR.
Well, the funny thing about, like, you know, again, all these people, like...
I buy Hebrew National hot dogs.
I don't actually do that, but I'm
good.
Not gonna,
it's a quality dog.
I bet it is.
I mean, they're all kosher anyway, for fuck's sake.
Right, look, I would love to buy NKC, non-kosher certified, 100% of my product. That's just not realistic. Like, it was just give me a fucking break.
So, speaking of, I saw, I don't know if it's like a double fake. I was at the grocery store. I saw this brand that was like, I was in Trader Joe's, the Swipple place, a little markup. But they had all natural, what do you call them? Like beef jerky, but like it's like the high end Slim Jims where it's like the long stick. I think they were, I don't know if it was bullshit, but I think they were doing a double bluff where they had huge kosher stuff on, like the biggest kosher, like it was a, not only a kosher symbol, it was not like, not the U with the circle, right? Okay. It was a K in a giant Star of David about the size of a quarter on the box.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, they're doing like a double, like, hey, it's got to be all beef because, you know, it's,
sure. We know it's like, yeah.
First ingredient on the ingredients list is kosher beef.
Oh man.
So they're really like selling out for, I forgot what the brand was called. I'm not going to give them free, whatever. But yeah. Like, it was an interesting double up on like, yeah, it's all beef because, you know.
Sure.
It's 6 million rabbis came in, three came through, and they all agree. They all agree.
But to return for a second to the 40K thing, like, what's been interesting is, okay, you know, all these, like, unnamed individuals who are, you know, shitting on just people who, my thing, frankly, is just, I did. Think it's a cool space fascist aesthetic. I don't particularly feel the need to defend that because it's pretty obvious. The Russians agree, and the, you know, it's been funny to see one of the kind of under again kind of one of these stories is going a little bit under the radar is this language about Russians being orcs. That's just kind of, you know, popped up in certain, you know, pro Ukraine spaces. Like, oh,
well, the Ukrainians are doing it as like a, that's one thing about how like these signals cross differently. So the Ukrainians are doing it as like a Lord of the Rings reference.
Yeah.
And the Russians are doing it as a 40K thing.
Like, fuck yeah. Wah!
Yeah.
They're literally painting like Wah banners on their tanks and shit.
Well, also the great thing is like that we haven't got, because I mean, warfare, American warfare has been like profoundly gay. So you like, they have like whole, hey, I don't think the Russians care too much. They also have like large Donbass militia factions. And there's no fucking rules about what you paint on your goddamn tanks.
And the Donbass are like huge anime respecters. So yeah, it's like, yeah.
But like, there's no, like, it's finally a war where they don't have rules on what you can't paint on your fucking tanks.
Right.
So you're going to get all kind of rad stuff. Guys painting all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Flying different flags.
Yes, the flag game has been yeah, everything from literally just like the Red Army banner to the Tsarist, like,
yeah. You know, and then there's like the Tsarist banner. Also, there's just like the Jesus one.
Yes. Which that is a great. There's some great pictures of just like just a Christ Pantocrator flying on a tank. Like, yeah, hell yeah. So yeah,
was there? There was one great one. It was, I think, two tanks in the same column. One had the Red Army and one had the Christ Pantocrator.
I mean, why not? Right? It's like, yeah, it's a different.
And then the guy with the other thing, I think probably for the same like issue. The guy had, I think it was a Donbass guy, had like written like Che Guevara on his Kevlar.
I haven't seen that one.
And the Christ flag behind him.
That's really funny. I haven't seen that picture, but it doesn't surprise me, of course.
Well, I mean, they're also like, there's notorious like your
shit posters.
No, just Rushkik, which is a Russian neo-Nazi, like whatever. I don't know what they call themselves these days, but they used to call themselves like a neo-Nazi recon battalion for Donbass, getting awards for defascinization, denazification.
Yes. Yeah, well, the whole thing, I mean, like, maybe we can...
what's the thing, you know, like, hail Hitler, let's go kill Nazis?
Right, exactly. It's like, I mean, you can't... The idea that this is a productive lens to examine the conflict through is just
or
retarded.
Or any Eastern European.
Exactly, it's just retarded. I mean, it's, you know... Well, what's funny, too, is I've seen increasingly on some of the English language, Russian, like, essentially, like, people in Donbass and Crimea who run English language Telegram channels doing like the coverage of the war, the ones who have like comment sections open have several different ones I've noticed have complained and said, the guys, knock it off with the pro-Nazi shit in the comments. We're denazifying Ukraine or whatever. And it's like, but these are your fans, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, it's been a trip.
Yeah.
So I've seen that actually three different channels have had to tell commenters to knock it off with the like specifically I think pro Hitler shit, because it's not even so much about like quote, you know, whatever Nazism means, but like specifically because I think that's the there's a kind of grug Russian nationalist that does see this in some way as an extension of or this kind of, I guess, cultural memory of, because many Ukrainian regions greeted the Third Reich quite understandably, quite reasonably, as liberators from the Bolshevik menace, and fought with Hitler's army. And this is, you know, the problem is it's not an ideological extension of that conflict, but it is to some extent an ethnic extension of that conflict. And that's unfortunate. And yeah, it's like, it just complicates everything in ways that are very sad and difficult and just unfortunate. But,
Yeah, like also like arguably like I don't know what the Russians like end goal is with the thing, but I'm. It seems like they're saying like they're really, well, we're just not going to take Lviv.
That seems well, like there have been rumors again. How much salt to take with? Who knows?
We're
going
to Poland.
Give it to Poland.
Yeah. And Poland will take it.
Obviously, they'll take it. Nobody's going to claim. I think that was actually the
which is funny because you got a thing with Polish nationalists don't want it. So like the ex, well, revanchists do. But yeah. Like national, like racial nationalists of Poland don't want to deal with this
like,
shit. Yeah.
Right. It's like not our, not something we want to have to have, not another problem that we need. But yeah, the rumors that I saw were essentially flying from the, it was Ukrainians who were worried. The rumors were essentially about Polish military personnel having talks with Russian military personnel and like,
probably not true.
Plans, yeah. Probably not. But yeah. But again, it shows you where their head is as far as like the threat that they see is essentially Polish quote unquote peacekeepers coming in from the West to like occupy these.
You call it the Czechoslovakia gambit,
right? Exactly.
It's like, oh, well, it looks like they've got this one on hand. I guess we'll take our little cut, and then, you know, and I hate you, you know.
It's like, exactly right. But you can see, you know, where their head's at and why, and it's a totally reasonable end game.
So the other solution. Thing I saw was the opposite. Actually, was Ukrainian. Once again, propaganda rumor mill was the Poles would agree to militarily garrison certain parts of Ukraine to free up troops for a Kherson offensive, which was they'd send two divisions or two brigades. It was usually two of something.
The Kherson offensive?
Yeah. That's a, I don't even want to talk about like what a fucking stupid thing. That's going to end. They're going to like, they've memed themselves into the Russians reinforcing the area. There's no attack coming, which means the Russians will then go on the offensive, and they
admitted it was a psyop. Did you see that? They straight up said, I mean, like Arestovich, the Baghdad Bob of this whole situation on the Ukrainian side was like, yeah, this was basically just to get the Russians kind of freaked out and, you know, pull some troops off Donbass.
But now they're gonna
well,
take
good job, idiot.
They're gonna take Nikolov and it's a whole, and then Odessa falls after that because of if you look at a map,
exactly.
Once Nikolov falls, Odessa's
toast. Over.
Because then you have like. You don't have to take Odessa. You can just cut it off from the rest of the whole thing, and it's over. You know.
And then what are they going to do? Because then they're landlocked, and then you know that. Right.
Then you can ceasefire negotiations start.
Right. And so I don't know. It's maybe to bring it all the way back to like not that we're in the business of making predictions. I don't feel the need to defend. Like I think every you know, it's entirely reasonable to have considered that like the Ukrainian military would have done what they should have done, which is to lay down arms more or less immediately. They didn't, and so here we are 6 months later. Probably about 100,000, I would estimate, if you add up both sides, KIA, probably about 85 Ukrainian and 15K Russian, approximately KIA, and then what, another 2 or 3 times that wounded? It's hard to say.
It's almost impossible to say, and it's going to come out after the war ends.
Right.
To some degree, accuracy.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's from what I've seen. That's probably like that's order of magnitude, right? So probably like 10. Let's say 10 to 20 Russian and 60.
Russian counters are really hard because everyone.
Well, they also count Donbass separately, right?
Yeah, right. Or they don't sometimes.
Or there's not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they'll include them if they want to, like pop the number up or what is. Yeah. Also, like it's also the thing. There's argue that there's like all these Donbass casualties that are happening, but like.
How much
there,
is that?
How many? There's like not that many Donbass actual fighter. Like I think 20,000 to 30,000. So they've been doing a draft and but like that's a lot of divisions, but for a tiny region. But like also you have Russian mercenary. Russia has now spun up a second Wagner Corps.
I didn't know that.
I don't know if they're like just for the duration of this, but they basically seem to be operating in the same areas. It's, the name. Is like I think.
Oh, I saw. Yeah, I did war, see this. Yeah. Oh, don't stop war.
Don't stop war.
Don't stop war. Yeah, I did see this. Yeah,
they're an offshooter,
which is kind of funny.
Yeah, like, yeah. Can't imagine they're gonna survive the conflict in terms of like the branding,
right?
They'll probably rebrand into like something corporate and stupid, or something cool like Wagner, or they'll just get folded into Wagner, right? Depending on how this goes.
Wagner is also the I wouldn't quite say unsung, haha. That's a joke. Heroes, but they'll
torture that guy to death. Probably. Sorry? He also tortured that guy to death, probably.
After the war?
No, the guy with the cut the walls off that guy was probably a Wagner guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's the rumors. It was a Wagner. Oof. Yeah.
But yeah, no, they've been doing a lot of the heavy assault work that was not getting done in the early phase of the war. And
like taking towns block by block kind of
exactly,
thing.
Exactly, yeah. like yeah, trench by trench.
Which is an interesting thing. Like they seem to be using a couple of auxiliaries, I guess you want to call them broadly, is them, Chechnya, the Republican armies, are being used for like, it's not open warfare, but it's like urban warfare is being done by these secondary groups, and then like open field warfare is being done by the army. Yeah. It seems like the most large advances
seems about right. Yeah.
Being done. Although I will say the what was it when the LPR was liberated fully, that advance was actually done by mostly LPR militiamen.
Well, in the LPR and DPR, in the Lugansk and Donetsk regions, it's those local militias that are essentially doing the bulk of the fighting for their own territory, which makes sense.
Also, the Kherson thing, arguably, is probably maybe there was all that gayop is that you it becomes more and more done by. Although I'm sure the Russians have also noted that there's they call them independent artillery battalions.
I'm not familiar with
this. It's like instead of being a part of a larger thing, it's just an artillery battalion. And I think they're supporting DPR, LPR forces.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's what I have to.
You cut off regular support.
Because they don't have all that artillery on their own. Yeah. So they rely on Russian regulars for fire support and just do the infantry stuff on their own. Especially at this point, I don't want to talk about timelines or anything, but it is clear sort of what's happening is the I guess the news. So we'll do maybe we'll close out with a
Strelkov got arrested, allegedly.
Arrested?
Yeah.
For what?
He's trying to sneak into Crimea with four credentials to go fight.
What a fucking retard! What?
Apparently, yeah. It seems like I don't think too much news on it, but apparently that's like the rumor or the news, or it's hard to see what difference.
Sure.
But. Apparently, he's arrested near Crimea trying to go fight. I mean, they're not going to slap on their wrist.
Yeah, clear.
Don't do it again.
Yeah, right. That's funny. He's, I guess, like.
He's supposed to go fight. He's
I understand why he would want to go fight, but whatever. Anyway. Yeah.
He might go back. He might, you know?
Well, I think you're. Okay, so round it out, as of current date, which is mid August. 2022, the Kherson, the much vaunted Kherson counteroffensive, just completely failed to materialize. Will never materialize. Just it's a total. There have been a couple, from what I've seen, abortive advances that were like zero fire support, instantly blown up, and just complete waste of human life for. I wouldn't even say propaganda purposes, because what propaganda did they even get out of it?
Yeah, there's this thing where both sides do this, where they when they recon a town on the no man's land, they'll declare they took it.
Right.
So you'll see, we took back this town because we reconned it. They pulled back. They reconned it. They pulled back. But then we reconned it. We pulled back.
I got caught on this with Seversk, which is a important strategically location on the in the northern part of the Donbass theater, on the way to Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, because it seems that the Ukrainians pulled out of the town. But they occupied the heights around the town, so the town is currently in the gray, what they call the gray zone of no man's land. There's not been much fighting over it because the attention shifted
to
south. The attention in that area focused. The town itself is essentially abandoned still. The at least by the military, neither military occupies it. The Ukrainian military is on the heights outside of it, but the actual fighting between the armies has shifted to. First Pesky, which seems and I didn't realize how close it was because I'd seen its name pop up of this town, but it's basically the first suburb of Donetsk, Donetsk City, a 15-minute drive, and that's where a lot of the two main sources of the shelling of civilians that have been done as war crimes, fully facilitated by NATO, who is fully complicit in these war crimes. The places where they're shooting at the civilians in Donetsk from are number one, Avdiivka, and number two, Pesky. Pesky seems to be now pretty much under control of the Russians as of the past week or so.
And that was almost purely DPR. I think it was Somalia, actually.
The Somali battalion?
Somali, and then the miners.
Yeah, the miners battalion. Yeah, I saw that. Well, yes. Who are they have all these names that they have. Could you imagine being a miner and you
that's fuck it, I'm arguably gonna... depending on how much Donbass propaganda you read, the core of it was two things. One, Stalin was paranoid and Stalin, not just Stalin, but every Russian leader is somewhat paranoid about nuclear war. And they were using Donbass mines
as
the
Tsar
as depots. So when they would abandon a mine shaft, they'd fill it with AKs and RPGs. For a theory for that will push into Ukraine. That's what the West always fears. Always been fearing a push by the West into Ukraine. It's like a historical fear. Yeah. And the miners like know about this stuff because they, it's like, why do we not go to that mine shaft anymore? Well, it's out of ore. Well, you know, somebody went once. So it's full of crates full of stuff.
Yeah.
And then that's how, according to Thomas Morganis, that's what they used for the initial core was the miners. The miners are considered like the first, like the most important or the first, like the George Washingtons of
the Minutemen.
Yeah, the propaganda is like, oh, the whole shift's walking off and like putting their foremen as their platoon leaders. And how much of that is true, who knows? You know? Right.
It's a cool story.
The miner to soccer hooligan ratio is probably less less impressive, less you know, less clean than they would like it. But yeah, you know.
Whatever. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So Pesky is like whatever 80-90% taken. It's mostly a cleanup operation at this point. Avdiivka is the from what I understand, they're pretty much equally fortified, which is to say, very very heavily fortified. These are among the most heavily fortified.
These were the front line for
eight years. This has like been built up continuously over that period of 8 years, and so now they're doing like positional
shaping operations.
Yes, trying to get ready for the assaults on. Specifically, Avdiivka seems to become because they've been doing. Oh, that again, one of these things you'll never see reported. I unfortunately had the misfortune of clicking open sensitive content on Telegram and seeing like 15-year-olds with their fucking legs blown off because the shelling isn't just like artillery shells. It's these, what do they call them, petal mines. These little like
basically bouncing Bettys, but via air kind of thing.
Yeah.
And made to wound kind of thing. Toe poppers is the other.
Made to blow your feet off, not to kill you. Yeah. And just laying them all over Donetsk City, and little kids are running onto them, and it's just absolutely, utterly horrific. And so what I've seen speculated multiple times over the past couple months, which it's totally plausible, is... a large part of the reason why they're doing that is to bait the Russians into a premature assault on the positions that they're committing these war crimes from. Seems like they finally got their wish. And these two areas...
Well, Pitsky fell pretty quick when the assault started. Yeah. It's both shoot firing at it, but like...
Yes. It didn't take super long. Avdiivka, they haven't, I don't think, really begun yet. But in any case, yeah, that does seem to be the priority at this point, is to finally get that taken care of, and then yeah, from there it's kind of I guess the obvious next step is that what do they call it, the Russians with attitude, the banana of doom, from Slavyansk, Kramatorsk down to Konstantinivka, in a kind of like semicircular shape, hence banana. I was expecting that as soon as, because they were really making a big push in the North Donbass, to look like Juk's going to drive on Kramatorsk, that I think as a result of this intensified shelling of civilians, the plan and I guess other stuff too, who knows.
Well, also like it's pretty serious, like just shelling of because Donetsk like is a populated city, like no one left.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
other
yeah,
people want to go fight. Like,
yes. But other, if the people who didn't,
I mean, there,
fight,
there were like women and children left in the early days, but it's, like, it's still like a industry, like not everybody left, right?
Right.
You saw the I think I've showed you that article, like the Hare Krishna is sending.
Yeah, I missed that somehow. But yes, there was Hare Krishna is distributing food, came under artillery fire,
and I think one or two died.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you think, you know.
Right. So clearly that's, I think, going to be, and I guess the question is, are they going to maybe, is it going to be simultaneously with the push in the south from Kherson to Nikolaev, or is it going to going to prioritize the southern offensive first after they get this kind of the immediate environs?
Well, if it seems like they're kind of letting the Donbass forces with like fire support do offensive operations for themselves, right? Like,
yeah.
I think one of they probably armies could. Obviously, Mariupol was huge, so they brought in like Chechnya and Russian National Guard, which is a whole different thing, similar to Chechens, how they operate, light infantry style. But also, there was also the fear of Mariupol that like they would just
level the whole thing.
No, they would just like kill all the people they captured.
Oh.
And they might do that at Avdiivka too, like telling the, you know.
Well, they've captured a number.
They didn't seem like they were killing everybody at Pietska. Also, like, I think they maybe understand like this probably the same guys that were there for the last 8 years, you know, it's a certain point, like, you know, those guys probably left a long time ago, to probably died somewhere else, you know. But yeah, no, it seems like the Donbass is much bigger than Lugansk in terms of army size. I think Lugansk had like 2,000 soldiers
Yeah, it was a couple thousand versus, like, basically like an order of magnitude difference
between the two. And then Dunboss had like 10,000 and has been tooling up since then. So it's hard to say. They could have up to 20 right now. They actually had issues with, I've noted, like, if you look at like deeper Russian stuff, like they're like, oh, you know, the DPR and the LPR are having issues because they had a lot of motivated conscripts, like obviously, because they're being shelled. But the problem was
their families were getting shelled. Yeah, I mean, you imagine.
But they had issues with getting so they had an existing like professional army and officers and sergeants. There weren't enough to go around. So you had like guys who were like, you know, a corporal is now a platoon leader or a company commander for like a bunch of conscripts. He doesn't know his job and they don't know their job. But also time, I think time has probably improved those. Yeah. The Ukrainians have the identical problem. And all the same thing, like the problem is the DPR units have a certain continuity because they're not being like destroyed. So like guys can kind of
get
grow into their job.
Yeah, whereas versus a
TDF is being led by a professional sergeant. It's now leading the company, and all half his guys died, and he dies, and it's like
source Rod Dreher. So obviously take it with a grain of salt, but I actually do believe, I think this is true. One of his supposed readers, I don't think this was a letter he wrote to himself. This was a letter he probably actually did get from someone who was apparently connected to the American intelligence services, who said that the median time between a Ukrainian conscript getting sent to the front and coming back in a body bag is 10 days. 10 days. And that's coming from essentially...
I guess at the Donbass front?
The front lines. Yeah, wherever, but like, yeah. If you're a Ukrainian conscript, you get sent to the front lines, you come back in a body bag 10 days later on average. So, I mean, that just to put it in perspective, right? I don't know. At some point, I hope we get like Nuremberg, but not fake. You know what I mean? Like for to deal with the criminals behind this.
Yeah,
would be nice, right?
What as like Donbass would say, like hail Hitler, hang these Nazis, right? Like, hang these Nazis, hail Hitler, hang this Nazi Jew Zelensky, right? Like
exactly. Did you have something on Roger? You want to wrap?
Yeah,
it up,
can or? We think we can psyop him into supporting Hungarian annexation of Western Ukraine? I feel like he's like vulnerable.
I don't know, it's like a
Transcarpathia is right there. It's part of Transcarpathia.
It's a train wreck that I can't, like Roderick is a train wreck that I can't stop staring at. And he's talked about the Transcarpathian thing not infrequently in the gayest way you could possibly imagine, as far as like, because he's like an Orban guy, right?
Orban's like, maybe he's made...
Absolutely. And not only that, he's talked about in the past, actually repeatedly, about how the Treaty of Trianon, that was essentially Hungary's separate peace with the... Allies.
Yeah, just the USSR, I think, right?
I don't remember. But it was basically... It was as a condition of the armistice in World War I, Hungary gave up two-thirds of its territory, which like was mostly... you know, ethnically Hungarians, but not exclusively ethnically Hungarians who were occupying. And that's where the gayness enters, because Rod is like, well, there were policies of Magyarization and the Hungarians were treating the ethnic minorities in these treaties, in these territories really badly. So you can understand why Hungarian revanchism about Transcarpathia is unacceptable. And I'm like, you fucking faggot. Can you stop being gay for like 30 seconds?
Yeah. Also, talk about Ukrainian agent. Like the Ukrainians do the same bit. Like,
absolutely.
They do their census by language. So when they do, so the first thing they do is hilarious, which is obviously they count Russian as a dialect of Ukrainian.
That's a cool flex.
Yeah. But they also count it by like what language you speak. So obviously, if you live in Transcarpathian Ukraine, you speak Russian or Ukrainian as well.
Sure.
So like, do you speak Russian or you speak Ukrainian? As a question on the census, would like,
sure, mean like
a certain level of Transcarpathian Hungarians get sorted into the Ukrainian category?
Yeah,
like I think I saw there's like a stat like 90% because people make on like NATO flags, like because basically what happened was, it was like months ago, a TDF unit that one of those that were like kind of rebelled or mutinied was from Transcarpathia, and people say, oh, it's kind of funny that like a Hungarian unit would be like, fuck this, right? Like,
yeah,
and people say, oh, it's Hungary, Transcarpathia, it's 90% Ukrainian and only 10% Hungary, 8% Hungarian. It's like, well,
yeah, but what? Yeah, exactly.
Source, census Ukraine,
right?
Language stats of Transcarpathia, which is like 90% Ukrainian speaking. It's like,
I mean, just because they speak it doesn't.
Yeah, like also think of like the. I mean, like Odessa is like Russian and Greek. It's like you should know Ukrainian or Galician. What do you even call it?
Galician. Yeah, it was, well, that would be, I guess.
Well, there's like Galician and also like Ukrainian, which is like a...
It's also but again, the fundamental issue here is that Ukraine is not a, it's a region. It's not a country. Like, it's a fake, the idea of Ukraine.
Yeah, this is a civil war between, it's like between, it's a civil war between Kiev and Moscow.
Yeah.
We were, you know, part of the same thing. It was, whether it's the Kievan Rus or the Moscovian Rus, both of those concepts both include Moscow and Kiev.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Like
both those theoretical nations.
Yes. So anyway, I'm about done. I'm recovering from an illness, and I'm all tapped out for now. But this has been a lot of fun. We apologize again to our audience for the extended hiatus. We won't be gone for that long. Yeah. We got some cool.
We're
stuff.
Considering reorganizing some of the format to compensate a little bit.
We'll see about like a part one, part two over time type thing. We'll see how that. We're going to try give it a try to do like to break things up a little more. We'll see how it goes, but. Yeah. In the meantime, don't fret. We will return with part three for sure part three of Elden Ring. Possibly finishing that out. We're going to be doing Syrian warfare. We're going to be doing a bunch of different stuff. So stay tuned and take care, everybody.
All right. See ya.
Dumb. Girls are dumb.